Fast Eddie here in the studios at EAA Radio. And in front of me here today, I have Commissioner Edwin Fountain of the World War I Centennial Commission. How are you today, Edwin?
Doing fine, Fast Eddie. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Well, we were chartered by Congress in 2013 and given the mission of orchestrating a proper observation in this country of the centennial of the war. The United States didn't enter the war until April 1917, so officially we kick off our centennial next year. But we've taken on as our mission two things, education and commemoration. Too few Americans know much about World War I, which was really the most consequential event in both U.S. and world history of the last 100 years. And second, commemoration to honor and recognize the service of 4.7 million American men and women who served in the war and 116,000 who died.
It was also the start of military aviation as well. How are you going to be featuring that in your celebration?
Well, it's one of the many stories that we tell about the history of the war, which has so many facets, but aviation is an important one of them. And I talked about the official start of the American Centennial being next year, but the unofficial start was really in April of 2016, because 100 years ago, in April 1916, seven Americans volunteered to fly for the French Air Service in World War I, and they formed the core of what became known as the Lafayette Escadrille, and a larger group called the Lafayette Flying Corps. And that was about 240 Americans, ultimately, who flew for the French before the U.S. entered. And after the U.S. did join the war, a number of those flyers came over and began flying for the Army Air Service. And about 69 of those men died in combat for both the French and the U.S. 49 of them are buried at the Lafayette Escadrille Memorial outside Paris. In 2018, we will be highlighting the Battle of Saint-Mihiel Salient in September of 1918, which was really the first full-scale deployment of American air power in support of a major ground offensive in the war. And then in between, we're partnering with the League of World War I Aviation Historians. We're actually meeting out at the Dawn Patrol in Dayton later this fall. And so there'll be a number of activities to highlight the advances in aviation in World War I.
Well, this celebration that you're doing, where is that going to be held?
Well, the Dawn Patrol will be at Dayton. That's their annual World War I air show. We don't have much of a physical presence. We were formed by Congress, but given no money by Congress. So like most organizations today, a lot of what we're doing is virtual. On our website, actually, is a very comprehensive timeline of aviation milestones in World War I across all the combatant nations, not just the United States, but Germany, France, England, and others. And it tracks the history of a lot of the famous aces of the war, a lot of the technological developments. And that's on our website, www.1cc.org. It's a permanent presence that people can go to and learn a lot about the role of aviation in World War I.
What is so important about World War I? It was 100 years ago. It's ancient history.
Well, that's a question we get a lot, and it's important for two key respects. The first is World War I defined the subsequent 100 years of history, both in this country and abroad. World War I saw the collapse of four different empires, and in the process unleashed a lot of conflicts and tensions that continue to affect the world today. So when you think about the current crises in Iraq and Syria, those countries, their borders were drawn by the French and British during World War I. All of those countries, all those border conflicts came out of World War I. And so you can't understand the geopolitical situation we deal with today without understanding that history. Here at home, World War I transformed the United States from being an inwardly focused, debtor, agrarian nation, safe behind the barriers of two oceans on either side, to a outwardly focused, industrial nation, and brought us into world affairs in a way that we never have retreated from. The second reason to remember World War I is because of the very scale of the service and sacrifice of American. We lost more men in combat, 53,000 men, in about 6 months of serious fighting in World War I than we lost in the entire 8 years of the Vietnam War. We don't have images. We don't have the Hollywood depiction of that war like we do the later wars. And so it's important to use the centennial to bring home to the American people that the courage and heroism and sacrifice of that generation of veterans was every bit as profound as that of later veterans that we commemorate.
Most people are familiar with World War I only through the Peanuts comic strip, Snoopy versus the Red Baron. In reality, there's a lot more to it than that.
Well, there sure is. The Meuse-Argonne Offensive in late fall 1918 that helped bring an end to the war is to this day the largest battle in American military history. We lost three times as many men in the Meuse-Argonne as we lost in the Battle of the Bulge. We were losing 10,000 men a month in World War I, which is more than we've lost in the last 15 years. And we just don't have those images. World War II has all the newsreels. It has all the great Hollywood films that came out in the 40s and 50s, all the way through to Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan. The Korean War had MASH. Vietnam we saw on our TV screens on the nightly news. We have Apocalypse Now and Platoon and other films. There are a lot of World War I films in the 20s and 30s. 1950s, but they've really receded in our consciousness, and we're trying to bring the war back during the centennial.
And aviation played a great role in it, because when World War I broke out, we were just barely flying.
It was less than 11 years after the Wright brothers, men started flying over the Western Front. You know, in the air show right now, there's some great World War I aircraft, and you can see they are not that far removed from the very first days of aviation. So the technology was developing, the tactics were developing. It was during the war that the Germans figured out how to synchronize a machine gun with the blades of a propeller so that a pilot could have a direct line of sight, point his plane at an enemy, and shoot through his propellers without disabling the aircraft. They went from an observation role to an aerial dogfight role, and then really to the beginnings of combined arms, where aviation was providing direct support to infantry and artillery on the ground as part of a combined offensive. And we saw that really for the first time at a large scale for the United States in the Battle of the San Miguel Salient. Anyone interested in aviation has to be interested in World War I.
There's a lot of people that came out of World War I that went on to greatly influence World War II. The people I'm thinking of are German, Hermann Goering, I think it was Hans Udet, who got his start in World War I. Of course, Goering became infamous in the Nazi regime, and Hans Udet.
Right, he was one of the great German aces of World War I. The other big name to come out is Billy Mitchell, father of the American Air Force.
And Eddie Rickenbacker was also involved, Indianapolis racer, aviator, and the founding of Eastern Airlines to the war.
That's exactly right. And then on the ground, you've got George Marshall, George Patton, Harry Truman, and Dwight Eisenhower. The time between World War I and World War II was a very short period of time. It was 20 years. And of course, most people attribute the cause of World War II to a lot of the decisions that were made after World War I. And so again, you cannot understand that history without understanding World War I and its consequences.
If you look at the history enough, you realize that World War II was kind of sort of a continuation of World War I.
People say that in time it will be referred to as the 30 Years' War of the 20th century, that it really was a single conflict about German desire to expand its influence in Europe and around the world, and the desires of Russia and France, as well as Great Britain, to contain Germany. And so it really was one single conflict with a 20-year halftime. Different ideologies at different points of the war. One was a war between empires, and then you had a war between fascism on the one hand and the democratic allies and their ally of convenience, communist Russia. And then, of course, the Cold War itself is a consequence of World War I. The Russian Empire fell after the war, gave rise to one revolution, and the second revolution, the communist revolution. And so the post-World War II history of our conflict with the Soviet Union itself ties directly back to World War I.
And of course, General Patton, who was a World War I and World War II veteran, he called it right.
He wanted to keep on marching to Moscow. That's
he
right.
He did. He said point blank that the next greatest enemy we were going to have was Russia.
Well, and the Germans made overtures toward us toward the end of the war to reach a ceasefire with Britain and the United States and collectively turn our attention to Russia, because they saw that threat coming from Russia as well.
And this is all traceable back to World War I. It's amazing sometimes how it works when you can look back in 2020 hindsight.
Absolutely right.
So now you've got this underway. Do you have any kind of a permanent memorial or anything planned?
We do. We have in Washington, D.C., national memorials to the three other great wars of the 20th century, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And Congress has authorized us to establish a national memorial to World War I. The site will be on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is the great diagonal boulevard between the Capitol and the White House. We will be anchoring the western end of that boulevard, one block from the White House, two blocks off the National Mall. It is already a memorial to General John Pershing, who was the commander of the American Expeditionary Force in World War I. And we will be redeveloping that site into a more comprehensive memorial, again, to honor the service of the almost 5 million men and women who served and the 116,000 who died in the war. And so the design process for that memorial is underway, and as is the fundraising. This memorial will receive no taxpayer dollars in the form of a congressional appropriation. It will be paid for entirely by private donation. So we hope your listeners will want to support that project. They can visit our website at www. 1cc.org and make a donation to the cause. We're also encouraging folks to get involved at their local and state levels. We're standing up state centennial commissions in all 56 states and territories. We're making an active push to bring attention to the local World War I memorials that are all around the country, often hidden in plain sight. They're memorials that people walk past, drive past every day and don't really notice or realize what they are. But on most of those memorials are listed the names of the men from that community who went and fought and died in the war. And those are our grandfathers and great-grandfathers and our neighbors, and all history is local. And so we hope that people will engage in the history of World War I in their own community, in their own interest areas like aviation, and from that be drawn to a broader appreciation of the war.
Well, it sounds like a very ambitious project for sure. And of course, the World Wide Web will help get it all out. And I wish you good luck.
Well, thanks very much, Vested. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Commissioner Edwin Fountain of the World War I Centennial Commission. My name is Fast Eddie, and this is EAA Radio.